The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post and the New York Times. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to learn about two explorers and their discoveries on islands that are not only thousands of miles apart, but also many years apart as to when the discoveries were made. First up is Carolyn Y. Johnson's article, Ancient Chesapeake Site Challenges Timeline of Humans in the Americas. As the editors note, an island eroding into the Chesapeake Bay offers tantalizing clues about when and how humans first made their way into North America. Johnson focuses on the work of a modern-day archaeologist and his explorations of an island located close to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Her article was published in the May 19, 2024 issue of The Washington Post. And so let us begin. Parsons Island, Maryland is the dateline. With the Chesapeake Bay sloshing at his knee-high boots, Darren Lowry stood back and squinted at a 10-foot-tall bluff rising above a narrow strip of beach. To the untrained eye, this wall of sandy sediment is the unremarkable edge of a modest island southeast of the Bay Bridge. To Lowry, a coastal geologist, its crumbling layers put the island rather at the center of one of the most contentious battles in archaeology. When and how humans first made their way into the Americas. The story of the first Americans has long been a matter of public and scientific fascination, undergirded at times by vicious disagreements. The timeline of when people arrived has shifted earlier in grudging steps over the past century, and scientists today mostly agree people were in the Americas at least 15,000 years ago. Lowry's site and others like it could revise the story again, pushing back the timeline earlier than most experts thought possible. In total, Lowry and a motley crew of collaborators have discovered 286 artifacts from the site on the island's southwestern edge. The oldest, they reported, was embedded with charcoal dated to more than 22,000 years ago, a time when much of the continent would have been covered in ice sheets. If Lowry is right, Parsons Island could rewrite American prehistory, opening up a host of new puzzles. How did these people get here? How many waves of early migrations were there? And are these mysterious people the ancestors of Native Americans? New claims of sites dated this far back face a wall of skepticism rooted in legitimate scientific scrutiny and in the threat they pose to long entrenched views. To complicate matters, Lowry, who has been affiliated with the Smithsonian but does much of his work independently, presented the results of his study of Parsons Island in a 260-page manuscript posted online rather than in a traditional peer-reviewed journal. The peer review process is designed to help validate scientific claims, but Lowry argues that in archaeology it often leads to a circle-the-wagon mentality, allowing the scientists to wave away evidence that doesn't support the dominant paradigm. He says he isn't seeking formal publishing routes because life's too short, comparing this aspect of academic science to the dumbest game I've ever played. Well, the island is also a challenging site to study for a variety of reasons, most poignantly because it is rapidly eroding as the island subsides and sea level rises. The spot where the artifacts were found is now covered by the choppy waters of the bay. The visit reinforced my will to invest my time into this time period because it's a very fragile record, said Sebastian Lacombe, an archaeologist at Binghamton University who visited the island in 2017. It's at risk of disappearing, and we're at risk of allowing these sites and artifacts to lose their meaning forever, he added. A weirdo kid. Lowry began exploring the Chesapeake shoreline as a child, wandering his backyard on Tillman Island, about 15 miles southwest from Parsons Island. In 1977, 9-year-old Lowry picked up a distinctive fluted stone projectile point. A few years later, he saw something similar on a documentary on public television in which a Smithsonian archaeologist explained it was a Clovis point, a relic of what most people then believed were the first Americans. For the last half of the 20th century, the peopling of the Americas followed a tidy narrative. Humans traveled from Siberia across a land bridge that connected Asia and North America during the last ice age, when sea levels dropped. They then migrated southward around 13,000 years ago, when the ice sheets covering the continent retreated and exposed a previously impassable inland route. These people, named after a site in Clovis, New Mexico, left behind distinctive fluted stone points that have since been found scattered across North America. Lowry turned to his dad and said, "I found one of those." He found more by walking the shoreline every day. Lowry made discoveries as he meandered, and he began to understand how seasonal patterns, sediment movement, wind, and waves could unearth ancient treasures. "I was a weirdo kid," he recalled. He trained as a geologist, and it was geology that initially attracted Lowry to study Parsons Island. In 2010, he published an article in Quaternary Science Reviews describing layers of windblown silt deposited between 13,000 and 41,000 years ago at Miles Point in eastern Maryland. But the geological record is like reading the Cliff's Note version of a book, and he was frustrated by an unconformity in the sediment layers where thousands of years were missing, like someone had ripped out those chapters. Lowry and a colleague were prowling around in a whaler looking for a spot that might fill in the blanks when they spotted a black streak of sediment rising up out of the bay. They pulled up to Parsons Island and thought they had found the Rosetta Stone to decode the geology. Parsons is a 78-acre island less than a mile offshore that is privately owned by the Cochran family, which uses it as a family retreat. With the Cochran's permission, Lowry and colleagues began to visit regularly. The bluff layers preserved a remarkably intact geologic timeline going back more than 40,000 years. Then one morning in August 2013, the team discovered a leaf-shaped prehistoric stone tool jutting out of the crumbling wall. They knew from the work they'd already done that it was probably quite old. On a recent visit to the island, geoarchaeologist Daniel Wagner demonstrated why. He stepped back to scan the cliff, then tapped a narrow spade into a light tan sediment layer just above his head. That, he said, is the geologic chapter where they'd expect to find Clovis artifacts. Lower layers were set down before Clovis. The palm-sized tool Lowry and his colleagues found came out of the dark sediment layer near their knees. The scientists used two methods to date the sediment around the artifact, both showing it was more than 20,000 years old. They scoured the beach on 93 visits and conducted a formal top-down excavation collecting the 286 artifacts. They sent out sediment to labs that specialize in studying ancient pollen and microfossils called phytoliths to help reconstruct the ecosystem at the time. Back then, this region wouldn't have been a coastline. The sediment tools are embedded in dates to the last glacial maximum, the scientific term for the most coldest period of the Ice Age. In the final analysis, Lowry thinks the artifacts may have been transported downslope before they were buried, making them between 15,000 and 20,500 years old. This was a swale where water was collecting, Lowry said, envisioning the ancient landscape. You've got a dune. It's got sedges and small trees on it that are windblown and all contorted, and then behind it you've got a little pond. That pond may have attracted a prehistoric bison, muskox, and llamas, whose fossilized molars he's found scattered on the island shore, and it may have been what attracted the mysterious people who left behind a cache of stone tools. A story in flux. Parsons Island is the latest addition to a growing list of what are called pre-Clovis sites. But while the long-held Clovis first theory has crumbled over the past three decades, that has only deepened the debate about how much early the first Americans arrived. Claims of early sites present a challenge on two fronts. The first is technical. Dating the site convincingly can be difficult, depending on the context. Sediments can shift or be disturbed. What at first looked like artifacts can turn out to be geofacts, created not by humans but by natural processes or animals. As a result, many pre-Clovis sites enjoy a Warhol-esque 15 minutes of fame, and then they disappear because of real problems with the geology or the methods, said archaeologist James Adovisio. In 1973, he began excavating Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania, which dated back 16,000 years. It was instantly mired in controversy, and the site still has its critics today. The second challenge reflects the culture of science. For a long time, people claimed to find pre-Clovis sites were swimming upstream against deeply entrenched thinking. Tom Delahaye, an archaeologist at Vanderbilt University, began working on a site in southern Chile called Monteverde in 1977, which was dated to 14,500 years ago. He recalled a group of researchers he calls the Clovis Police, scientific gatekeepers who summarily rejected any pre-Clovis sites, sometimes for valid reasons and sometimes as a knee-jerk reaction. Monteverde began to change that. In 1997, a group of respected archaeologists visited the site and declared it authentic. It took about 25 to 30 years for Monteverde to be accepted, Delahaye said. We went through hell. Lowry says he isn't interested in running that gauntlet. He noted that he drew on multiple labs and methods for dating the Parsons Island artifacts in an effort to ensure that any one extremely old date isn't a fluke. He also invited other researchers in to visit and study the site. That approach irritates some scientists. David Meltzer, an archaeologist at Southern Methodist University, said in an email that he would not discuss Lowry's claims until they go through the ringer of peer review and get published. Others like Stuart Fidel, an independent archaeologist based in western Massachusetts who has been skeptical of other sites, say the site should not fly under the radar just because of Lowry's unconventional process. There are people I know in the field who will not pay any attention to it because it has not been peer-reviewed, which I think is kind of sticking your head in the sand, Fidel said. It's there. We can act as if nothing's been found there. A trigger issue may be the site's rapid erosion. Most of the artifacts were found after they'd fallen out of the bluff, which means their place in the geologic timeline is obscured. 9 artifacts were found in place, and only 3 were able to be dated using charcoal flecks found next to them. Stephen Foreman, a geoscientist at Baylor University, helped date the sediment layers at Parsons Island, corroborating findings from another lab. He said that it's hard to find the artifacts in the kind of bulletproof geological context needed to support extraordinary claims. The case is not as tight as we'd like to see it with other sites, Foreman said. Michael Waters, an archaeologist at Texas A&M University who has worked on pre-Clovis sites and excavated at Parsons Island, thinks he's probably got there too late when most of the artifacts had already been eroded out. Still, he pays someone to monitor the bank profile on a regular basis because he's ready to jump on a plane if they see something in place. Too bad we didn't get there 4 or 5 years sooner, Waters said. Enter ancient DNA. Parsons Island isn't the only site that could dramatically push back human arrival in the Americas. Last fall, a study published in the journal Science described fossilized human footprints discovered at White Sands National Park in New Mexico that had been dated to between 21,000 and 23,000 years ago. That stunning finding suggests people were here during the Ice Age, much earlier than most experts thought possible if the first humans arrived via the Bering Land Bridge and Inland Corridor. The dates at White Sands are still being disputed because of questions about the methods. But the timeline collides head-on with another exciting line of evidence, studies of ancient DNA. By examining genetic material preserved in bones and teeth and comparing those samples to modern populations, scientists have been able to track when populations mingled and became isolated from one another, offering a new window into patterns of human migration. In broad strokes, they've found that the ancestors of Native Americans split from ancient Siberian populations no earlier than 23,000 years ago. The studies can't say where such splits took place, but many scientists interpret genetic evidence to mean that the ancestors of modern people weren't in the Americas until much later. Genetic studies suggest that Native American ancestors traveled into what is now the United States between 17,500 and 14,600 years ago. Joe Watkins, a senior consultant for archaeological and cultural education consultants in Tucson and a Choctaw tribal member, said that he sees a few problems with using the still-evolving DNA evidence to decide how ancient sites are related to modern-day people. "The reality is genetics does not equal culture," Watkins said. He also argued that there are still too few samples of ancient DNA in the Americas to be sure they capture the whole story. "Trying to create population histories based on 10 people, if you will, is a little bit of a scientific conundrum," Watkins said. It could be that additional ancient genomes will one day help fill in the blanks. Another possibility is that earlier sites could represent small, isolated groups of people who didn't contribute to the ancestry of living Native Americans. Let's suppose you have a successful population colonizing an area, and then one day 15 males go out and get eaten by a short-faced bear, Lowry said. You reduce the genetic diversity and bada-boom, bada-bing, bada-bang, game over. All this explodes the neat picture of one population migrating into the Americas as ice sheets retreated, hunting big animals like mammoths and giant sloths, driving them into extinction as they went. If there were small groups making their way into the New World with different stone tool technologies and far earlier than previously believed, how did they get there? Well, people could have migrated along the coast by boat following a kelp highway. It's also possible the ice sheet was not as impenetrable as experts have long thought. Lowry's longtime collaborator, Dennis Stanford, proposed that people crossed the Atlantic Ocean in what is known as Solitrian hypothesis, though that idea has been rejected by many archaeologists. To resolve the question, scientists need to keep looking for more evidence. Archaeology is a historical science, and unlike chemistry or biomedicine, where researchers can perform the same experiment over and over again to see if they get the same results, consensus is built by argument, counter-argument, and new evidence. To a certain extent, older ideas and prejudices also fall away as new people enter the field, said James Feathers, who performed dating on samples from Parsons Island before he retired from the University of Washington. Sometimes you have to wait for people to die off, Feathers said. Lowry is determined to keep motoring around the Chesapeake, researching the ephemeral landscape that he loves and that may contain clues about human prehistory. He acknowledges that the sites, perhaps a little bit like him, are persnickety and that he shouldn't deter interest in them. Instead, it should spur more. He noted that if a pod of silverfish was found gnawing on documents in the National Archives, people would be galvanized to act. "I view it as my swan song," Lowry said. "To say you can learn a lot from an eroding site if you do a little bit of effort, and it looks at it systematically." There you go. So some interesting exploration going on near the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Well, our next article is headlined, "How Charles Darwin Found Inspiration in the Cape Verde Islands." Written by Ben Crair, it was published in the January 3, 2024 issue of the New York Times. Charles Darwin was 22 years old when he first peeled a banana. Mawkish and sweet with a little flavor. He noted in his journal from Santiago, the main island in the Cape Verde archipelago off the coast of West Africa. He preferred oranges and tamarinds, feasting at every opportunity on tropical fruit after the awful weeks at sea. Darwin was so seasick at the start of his five-year voyage aboard the HMS Beagle that the captain expected him to jump ship back to England as soon as they touched land, but he found his feet on the island called St. Jago, where he spent his first hours strolling through coconut groves and hearing the notes of unknown birds and seeing new insects fluttering about still newer flowers. Most travelers questing after Darwin head to the Galapagos Islands, where an entire tourist industry has developed around his legacy. It was the Galapagos where Darwin, according to popular legend, discovered natural selection, though in reality, it was only later in London that he grasped the significance of the finches and other animals he collected there. Still, by the time Darwin reached the Galapagos in 1835, he was a seasoned naturalist who had spent nearly 4 years on the Beagle. The Darwin, who arrived on Santiago on January 16, 1832, was naive and untested, with only European soil beneath his fingernails. Cape Verde, then a Portuguese colony, gave Darwin his first taste of his own scientific talent. He caught a glimpse of his own powers and recognized a new kind of desire, the wish to make a contribution to the world of philosophical natural history, wrote Janet Brown, his biographer. An island's inspiration. Today, Cape Verde is an independent nation of 10 islands and nearly 600,000 citizens speaking Creole and Portuguese. Tourists from Europe usually head to Sol in Boa Vista, where resorts partition white sand beaches. Adventurous visitors climb the active volcano on Fogo or celebrate Carnival on São Vicente. More Cape Verdeans live on Santiago, though, than in any other island. The architecture, music, and cuisine blend West African and Portuguese influences. In the capital, Praia, you can snack on papaya from the market or pastel de nata, a Portuguese custard pastry from a bakery. Santiago stood out to me ever since I read Darwin's life story. I wanted to see the island that inspired him to become a scientist we celebrate today. So last March, I checked into the boutique hotel Praia Maria, a simple hotel on Rua 5 de Julho, in a pedestrian boulevard in the plateau, Praia's historic center. Across from the hotel, an enormous mastiff paced on a red tile roof, barking at passers-by below, women selling strawberries and SIM cards, men in suits headed to government ministries, German cruise ship passengers huddled around tour guides. Eager to see where the Beagle docked, I made my own way down to the boulevard, past the cafes serving cachupa, a stew of corn, beans, and root vegetables, and Square Sobradre, which is townhouses with painted shutters and open doorways, revealing shelves of groceries and souvenirs. The road led through the main square, dominated by a colonial church, to a clifftop promenade with a statue of the Portuguese explorer Diogo Gomes presiding over the harbor. A modern-day port operates now on the harbor's eastern edge. The Beagle's base was an islet in the center, which Darwin called Quail Island and is known today as Ilha Santa Maria. On the harbor beach, some fishermen agreed to take me to the islet by boat. While they cracked tiny clams with rocks and ate them raw, I gazed into tidal pools and carpets of pink and green coral. It was in pools like these that Darwin found octopuses that changed colors and seemed to glow at night. He wrote a mentor in England describing his first big discovery, only to learn later that the octopus' powers of camouflage were already well known. A budding geologist, for all of Darwin's rhapsodizing about Santiago's tropical fruits, the island is largely dry, brown, and inhospitable outside a few irrigated valleys. Nature here is sterile. Nothing breaks. The absolute stillness. Nothing is seen to move, Darwin wrote. The most common animals, he noted, were an endemic sparrow and a kingfisher with a gray head and bright blue tail feathers, the only brilliantly colored bird that I saw. I observed the same birds nearly everywhere I went on Santiago, as well as cattle, egrets, guinea fowl, brown-necked ravens, and collared doves. Santiago's animals did not spark Darwin's interest in the origin of the species. He was more curious about the rocks. Geology is at present my chief pursuit, and this island gives full scope for its enjoyment, he wrote in his diary. In that spirit, I hired a local geologist named Javier Rodriguez as my guide. I know every road of Cape Verde, Mr. Rodriguez assured me. He picked me up at the hotel in a red pickup, and we drove along the edge of the harbor on a road called Avenida Charles Darwin, which is one of the island's few memorializations of his visit. Cape Verdeans don't really know Darwin, said Mr. Rodriguez, who carried a book by Antonio Correa Silva, an island historian who laid out a Darwin trail of sorts around Praia. Our first stop, though, wasn't on the map, an unfinished housing subdivision on the southeast tip of Santiago. The deserted neighborhood ended at a cliff with a bike lane beneath a string of lampposts, which could have been grafted from Amsterdam. We walked through scrub land and down a narrow road on the face of the cliff, our footsteps unloosing gravel into the thrashing Atlantic. On entering the harbor, a perfectly horizontal white man in the face of sea cliff may be seen running for some miles along the coast, Darwin recounted in The Voyage of the Beagle. His teachers believed the Earth's features had been formed by violent cataclysms, but on the Beagle Darwin had been reading The Principles of Geology by Charles Lyell, a Scotsman who argued that the Earth was shaped by gradual processes unfolding constantly over long stretches of time. Lyell's work taught Darwin to see nature as the accumulation of tiny incremental changes, a perspective that would inform his thinking later as he studied the plants and animals he had collected on his journeys. When developing his theory on the origin of species, Darwin said he was merely following the example of Lyell in geology. Speculating on the origins of Santiago's rocks was like the pleasure of gambling, he told a friend. That white band of limestone, he noticed, was sandwiched between two thicker layers of black basalt and became especially apparent on the sea cliff Mr. Rodriguez showed me. Darwin reasoned that the bottom layer must have flowed into the sea from the island after a volcanic eruption. The limestone accumulated on top as small aquatic creatures died and fell to the seafloor. Another eruption then sealed the limestone beneath the second layer of basalt before the entire structure rose from the sea. Piecing this together, Darwin wrote later, convinced me of the infinite superiority of Lyell's views. An enormous bobob and a wild song. Mr. Rodriguez drove me along the southern coast of Santiago to Cidade Velha, the first of European town in the tropics and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We sat on the veranda of a beach restaurant and watched spear fishermen haul in yellowfin tuna, and we ate from the grill. In town, children, school children, crowded into the main square around an obelisk memorializing the slave trade. The Portuguese arrived in Santiago in the 15th century and used the island as a waypoint between West Africa and Brazil. Darwin mentioned slavery only briefly in his Santiago journals. He suspected a very pretty schooner in the harbor of being a slaver in disguise, but was repulsed by the cruelty he soon witnessed in South America. The main road of Cidade Velha led uphill to the ruins of the oldest church south of Sahara, where centuries-old tombstones are still legible in the rubble. Pirates ransacked Cidade Velha repeatedly, and in 1770, the Portuguese moved the capital to Praia, which was easier to defend. Traditional stone homes lined an old side street called the Rua Banana, some of the houses hugging the curb so closely that you could practically knock on their wooden doors from the center of the road. We continued to a village in the interior called São Domingos, and on the way, Mr. Rodriguez turned into a narrow valley and parked beneath an enormous baobab tree on a dirt road between two fields of sugarcane. Baobabs bear leaves only a few months of the year, and the tree was bare except for some fuzzy brown fruits hanging from its branches. Parentheses here, their juice is called calabacia. It's thick, velvety, and slightly sour, and was my favorite part of breakfast in Praia. And visitors had carved their names into the gray bark of the baobab's isolated trunk, a whim that apparently goes back many centuries. When he passed by here, Darwin said the tree was completely covered with initials and dates as anyone in Kensington Gardens. He measured the tree 13 feet in diameter and no more than 30 feet tall, and felt that the numbers showed a faithful delineation of nature and does not give an accurate idea of it. So there you go. And she writes at the end, after many months of my trip, Mr. Rodriguez's company, Sandemar, installed sing boards at many of the locations along the Darway, and that was mapped in Mr. Silva's book, and perhaps Cape Verdeans would have new opportunities to learn, after all, about the curious Englishman who visited their capital dome so many years ago. And there you go. That wraps up today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.